From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Democratic presidential candidates last night made their case for the nomination and the final debate of the year, capping off a historic week in Washington with the impeachment of President Trump.
It was historic. And by the way, Tanya, just 45 days
until
the Iowa caucuses. So let's bring in our Friday politics roundtable. We've got Beth Fooey. She's politics senior editor at NBC and MSNBC. Hi, Beth.
Hi there.
And Kimberly Atkins, Washington reporter for WBUR. Kimberly, good to speak with you.
Happy Friday.
And how about this moment last night when Elizabeth Warren goes after Pete Buttigieg for holding a fundraiser in a cave with a crystal chandelier and $900 bottles of wine? Let's listen.
Billionaires in wine caves should not pick the next president of the United States.
Mr. Mayor, your response. You know, according to Forbes magazine, I am literally the only person on this stage who's not a millionaire or a billionaire. So if this is important, this is the problem with issuing purity tests you cannot yourself pass.
Beth, this is an issue turning out to be a major divide in the moderates and progressives in this party. We saw it play out in a big way last night right there. How important was that exchange?
Well, it sounded like it was a moderate versus progressive exchange, but in fact, it was really Elizabeth Warren trying to climb back into her positioning as of September, October, when she was really riding high. She has really fallen off in polling over the last couple of months, and she's not necessarily losing her edge to Bernie Sanders, her fellow progressive. She's losing it in large part to Pete Buttigieg, who has been on the rise. He's been on the rise in Iowa, which is where Elizabeth Warren has really staked her claim, where she's got her biggest effort and really has been you know, gunning to win for a year. She's got a ton of resources there. But Pete Buttigieg has proven to be pretty popular with a lot of the voters that Elizabeth Warren has been seeking, those college-educated kind of white liberal voters. So she really had to go after him to kind of reclaim her status. Whether or not that was successful, we shall find out because she was tough and he was tough right back.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Joe Biden. He referred to Republican accusations that he and his son acted corruptly in Ukraine, a key Republican talking point in the impeachment of President Trump. And Biden said he'd still reach across the aisle.
We need to be able to reach a consensus. And if anyone has reason to be angry with the Republicans and not want to cooperate, it's me. The way they've attacked me and my son and my family, I have no love. But the fact is, we have to be able to get things done.
Kimberly, there was a lot of analysis today that Joe Biden had a really good night because no one on the stage really went after him. Do you agree?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest goal for Joe Biden was to do no harm, right? He's doing pretty well in the polls and also to address this issue. He is a central figure in the fact pattern leading up to the impeachment. And on the campaign trail, he hadn't done a great job of really messaging that. He did a much better job on the stage last night. He avoided hits from other candidates. And so he came out with his strong lead likely holding for now.
But Kimberly, why not go after Joe Biden if he is leading in all the national polls?
Well, look, it's always a dangerous calculus, right? How far do you try to beat up on each other, especially this close to these primary races, or how much do you try to make your own case? I think for other candidates, particularly people like Pete Buttigieg or Amy Klobuchar, it was important for them to sort of make their own statement as well as swiping, and maybe hitting Joe Biden wouldn't be the best target. It's the other people who are pulling or who are there in the same lane with. And I think that's what you saw play out last night.
Can we talk a little bit about Amy Klobuchar? She had a lot of jokes and one-liners last night, by the way. She took second place to Bernie Sanders in most time spent talking. She had several standout moments, including this one where she broke up a fight over Medicare for all between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders.
First time I did this.
Okay, that's true. I'll say this. First of all, Bernie, I promise when I am your president, I will get our pharmaceutical bills done. And we have worked together on this time and time again, and I agree with you on that. But where I disagree is I just don't think anyone has a monopoly on bold ideas. I think you can be progressive and practical at the same time.
So she's starting a 3-day bus tour through Iowa today, but she's only polling in the single digits there. Beth, what's her strategy?
Well, doing really well at that debate last night was certainly key to what she's trying to do. And so far, the reviews have been pretty good. Look, we all have to keep in mind that since the last debate, the MSNBC debate in November, Kamala Harris has dropped out of the race. And that left a void for both, you know, female candidate, somebody who's sort of trying to be a consensus builder. And Amy Klobuchar decided to sort of step into that void and sort of be that voice on the debate stage last night. She's been, you know, trying to eke out that role throughout the year that, you know, she's the Midwestern gal who has won a lot of conservative voters in her purple state of Minnesota, and that she has the sort of the magic sauce to win the presidency based on that. But let's face it, she was also pretty tough. She went right after Mayor Pete, basically accusing him of never really winning an election of any significance. Mm-hmm. She sees him as an obstacle to her path, as does Elizabeth Warren. So she pulled no punches with him.
Beth, want to stay with you. What about Bernie Sanders? He's in the top four, one of the leaders in this race. What was his key moment?
Well, he, you know, Bernie Sanders is nothing if not consistent. He talks about income inequality, the fact that the 1% is holds all the power and money in this country, and that it's fundamentally a broken system in Washington. He makes that point basically no matter what question he's asked. That works for him a lot of the time. He's an effective speaker. But last night he bumbled a little bit when he was asked a question about race, which has been mm-hmm. a bit of a challenge for him both in 2016 and now, sort of winning over black voters. And he basically told the moderator of the debate that he wanted to go back and talk more about climate change, which probably wasn't the best approach to that question. And she pulled him back. He did, of course, you know, say, well, climate change has most adverse effects on people of color. He didn't totally bollocks the moment, but it was a little inelegant.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit, though, more about that. Andrew Yang actually stood out for a moment when he talked about being the only candidate of color on stage last night.
It's both an honor and disappointment to be the lone candidate of color on the stage tonight. I miss Kamala. I miss Corey, though I think Corey will be back.
What did we learn about him last night, Kimberly? The Yang gang seems to be very strong. We had someone who was out there, saw all of the signs for him out there. There seems to be a surge in perhaps his support.
Well, you know, he has had a core support of Yang gangers from the beginning of this. I think we still haven't seen that really translate to a broader appeal. I mean, he too, in all of his answers, brought it back to this $1,000 rebate that he has built his campaign around. And we've heard all the candidates talk about issues affecting people of color, everything from income inequality to the difference in life expectancy. But what was really absent, and what was surprising to me, is that there weren't a lot of solutions to that beyond general economic terms. And so I don't know in that sense if anybody made real leeway when it came to black voters and other voters of color.
Well, what's surprising to me is that we've gone this far without talking about impeachment and the week that we just had in Washington. Lawmakers left Congress for the holidays. We are still at an impasse over what is going to happen next, because Nancy Pelosi hasn't brought the articles of impeachment over to the Senate. And last night on Fox News, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said President Trump is demanding his day in court. Let's listen.
He's mad as hell that they would do this to him and now deny him his day in court. The reason they're denying him his day in court, they know their case sucks.
All right. So, but what is going to happen? I mean, are we going to have a trial in January? Are we not? What's the latest on that, Beth?
Well, I mean, what Lindsey Graham's saying isn't exactly right. She's not nobody's denying him a trial. She just hasn't sent the articles over yet. That doesn't mean she's never going to do it. In fact, you know, constitutionally, it indicates that she has to.
She does.
So she will at some point.
Yeah.
Well, there's some debate about that among constitutional scholars. But yes, the expectation is that she must. But she's playing some hardball here. She's hoping that it helps with Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader of the Senate, get some leverage over trying to see about getting President Trump to testify, perhaps other witnesses to testify up there. But of course, Mitch McConnell's giving it right back and saying that this strategy of the Democrats is nuts and the case is weak and flimsy. So it's two real, you know, political hardball players, Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell, going right at it with each other. And we will see who prevails. But, you know, Nancy Pelosi has been a pretty canny operator throughout this entire process and, in fact, throughout this entire year. So one can guess that she has an end goal in mind here, and we will see what that is after the first of the year.
Yeah, there's so much more that also happened in Washington this week. But I also want to ask you guys about this Christianity Today publication from the late Billy Graham. He founded this, said that Trump is profoundly immoral. Trump also said a lot of things that have a lot of people in Michigan perhaps upset, calling the late Senator John Dingell, he's saying some things about his widow. Do you see that Trump has so much hold over the Republicans with the 30 seconds we have?
Kimberly. Yeah, you know, there has always been a segment of evangelicals who were not behind Trump, who weren't behind him in 2016 and remained against him. But everything that you're talking about and everything that this editorial talked about are things about Donald Trump that existed since 2016, since he ran. And so it's unclear whether that will affect any of his core base support.
Yes, Beth Fooey is politics senior editor at NBC and MSNBC. Kimberly Atkins is Washington Post reporter for WBUR. Thank you both.
The chat bot on Sheila's phone is supposed to ask her questions, but when she starts asking it questions, it sends her poetry.
Secret dwelling place, mysteries held in the dirt. Time has other plans.
What happens when you treat artificial intelligence with love? On the new episode of Invisibilia from NPR.
A $1.4 trillion budget deal is awaiting the president's signature today after Congress passed a funding bill yesterday to avoid a government shutdown. The deal includes $30 million in extra money for senior nutrition programs. About 10 million seniors are at risk of going hungry in the United States, but funding for these programs has barely kept up with inflation over the past decade. Let's bring in Meals on Wheels America CEO and President Ellie Hollander. She runs the umbrella organization that fundraises for about 5,000 Meals on Wheels organizations around the country. These local programs deliver more than 200 million meals for more than 2 million people each year. Ellie, welcome.
Thanks so much, Peter.
And just looking at this budget that Congress is sending to the president's desk, it sets aside about $930 million a year for senior nutrition programs. Is that enough?
Well, first of all, we're delighted to see an increase, critically important because we've seen a decrease in the number of meals we've been serving over the years because funding is not keeping pace. That answers your question. We still need more.
Well, you say you're serving fewer meals. It's actually 21 million fewer meals than 2005. Why is that? And how big is the demand, the need to feed seniors around the country?
Well, that's a huge amount, of course, because the senior population is the fastest growing segment. We have mounting waiting lists across the country. We have people who aren't even being added to a waiting list because there's no hope that they'll be able to, in their lifetime, get off of one. So the need continues to grow as the segment grows, and we're all living longer, unfortunately, with more chronic conditions, but we want to live at home. So Meals on Wheels is critically important that we provide that kind of resource because it also saves money in the end.
Talk to me more about how the program works. Like, you know, what kind of meals are you serving people?
Well, delicious meals, I'd like to
say,
Pierre.
So.
Absolutely. Nutritious meals that are designed specifically for so the unique nutritional needs of seniors. In some cases, they're culturally tailored or medically tailored, depending on the specific needs.
Are they already cooked?
Some are cooked. Some, actually, of our programs have commercial-sized kitchens delivering 5,000 meals a day. Some of those programs actually prepare meals for other smaller programs. And some are cold meals or groceries that may be prepared by a local caterer or that may be drop-shipped if it's, say, in a rural area where it's difficult to make a daily delivery. We also provide meals in group settings, senior centers, and so forth, where more mobile seniors can come and have a meal with their friends.
Well, it's more than food delivery, isn't it? I see that you've launched a new app this year that will help your volunteers kind of track the physical and emotional well-being of the people that they're serving.
Exactly, Peter. We say that this is more than a meal. I say that the meal is the entree into the home, if you will, but that it's as much about the companionship and the socialization that happens, the friendly visit, the eyes and ears in the home, the ability to note if there is a change in the mental or physical health of the senior, which is what this change of condition app enables us to do in real time. A volunteer may notice something or may have a conversation with a client, a senior client, who says, you know what, I'm having trouble making it to the restroom, or I do have a home repair I need help with. This enables us to send a notification to whoever the person is that's a contact person and actually make that remediation in real time sometimes. Mm-hmm.
It looks like 40% of your funding comes from the federal government, which is a pretty sizable chunk. But what about private donations? Are you keeping up with that?
Gee, you know, I wish that we could get private philanthropy to step up even more. Unfortunately, seniors and aging are not the most powerful issues that attract philanthropists. And by philanthropists, I mean it could be you and me, Peter. Hmm. Anybody that can make a donation is a philanthropist in my mind. But less than 2% of all foundations, corporations, individuals are giving to seniors and aging. I also think that we need to do a better job in our country of demystifying what it means to age and to get older. And we did a campaign not too long ago with the Ad Council, America Let's Do Lunch, to invite a new generation of volunteers to experience the characters behind the door, that when you're knocking on the door, these are folks that have wonderful stories. These are our parents, our grandparents, our teachers, our postal workers. And I think that in our country, there's just sort of a little bit of a fear factor. We're not animals and we're not children. We don't want to pit ourselves against worthy causes, but we really do need the public to step up and help bridge that gap.
I want to go back to something you said earlier, which is that many cities across the country have wait lists to get into this program. We see in Kaiser Health News that in Dallas, it's a major problem. In Memphis, it can be, what, as much as a year wait? The entire state of Maine is suffering under a wait list to get into this program. What happens to those people who need food but aren't getting it?
Well, it is shocking. And we do know that based on Meals on Wheels programs that participated in a survey we did recently, that about 50% have waiting lists that range anywhere from 2 weeks to over a year, to your point. Average 4 months, some programs don't even take waiting lists. It's a real problem. And what do? We simply have to make trade-offs. Our programs tell us they feel that they're playing God on a daily basis. Who needs it more than someone else? Mm. Because if the resources aren't there, what do?
I don't mean to sound alarmist at all, but it does make me wonder if you have seen cases of people dying of starvation.
Personally, no, I have not. But I can tell you that based on my own experience in volunteering with Meals on Wheels, I've seen everything from somebody who had fallen before I got there to someone who perished. But obviously, the people we're seeing are people that are getting meals. I'm worried about the people who aren't. Malnourishment alone costs our country $51 billion in medical economic burden annually. Senior falls cost our country $50 billion annually. You make a small investment in a proven intervention like Meals on Wheels, where you can actually provide meals to a senior for an entire year for the same cost of being in the hospital for one day or a nursing mm-hmm. home for 10. So not only is it a socially important thing to do, but economically, we can save billions of dollars in taxpayer dollars.
And yet the economy is strong, and it has been for years. And I'm hearing you tell me that seniors are legitimately struggling. Is the health of the economy just completely disconnected from this issue?
I think it's a real issue, which is why we're trying to work very closely with healthcare, because we believe that Meals on Wheels is part of the healthcare solution. If you look at the top 5% in healthcare costs of the individuals that are contributing, not that they want to be, but that they are, the 5% are the people that we're seeing every day. And the top 5% of the high-risk, high-need population is contributing 40% to Medicare costs annually. So this is an opportunity for us to rein in healthcare costs and sort of what you've heard, you know, bend the cost curve. For a small investment, we can see significant improvements in healthcare outcomes and in a reduction in healthcare costs.
That's Meals on Wheels America President and CEO Ellie Hollander, with a reminder that there are people who are in need in this country, not just this time of year, but all year round. Ellie, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate
it. Thanks, Peter.
And how about a little more from a conversation I had last week with soccer superstar Megan Rapinoe? She'd just been awarded Sports Illustrated Sportsperson of the Year Award for leading the U.S. women's team to its fourth World Cup title earlier this summer, and for her activism off the field. We covered a lot of territory that did not make it into last week's interview, including how Rapinoe came to terms with her sexuality while growing up in a conservative part of Northern California. She's from Redding in Shasta County.
I didn't know, shockingly, this is like the greatest shock of all time. I didn't know that I was gay until I got to college, and then I figured it out, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is like the biggest oversight in the world. But, you know, part of it, yeah, I didn't see it a lot when I was younger, and it wasn't sort of explicitly spoken about in terms of having that language. It wasn't something that was spoken about negatively in my house by any means, but it just wasn't really spoken about and wasn't really spoken about in school. So I didn't personally have a hard time coming to it, because once it sort of clicked, it all made sense, and I was like, oh, my God, my life can finally start in its sort of holistic sense. But, and I think, honestly, the community in Reading, the people of Reading, all the people that I know, they were totally fine with it. And I think that, you know, having known me and known the kind of person that I am and all of that, sort of changed their minds about maybe some of the stereotypes or the misconceptions that they had about people who are gay. So I understand everybody doesn't have that experience. I'm very lucky to not have struggled the way so many do. But I actually feel like my community was sort of, I guess, accepting me with outstretched arms in a way. And while maybe they don't totally understand it, they understand me. So that makes sense to them.
We also talked about something important to any athlete, her age. What are you, 34?
34, yeah.
Are you almost done with soccer?
Probably.
What's the body tell you?
Yeah.
What's
your body telling you? Actually, I feel pretty good, to be honest. I think for females, honestly, the peak in your physical career is much later than it is for guys. So I think that you're going to see a lot more females playing much later into their career, and guys as well. I mean, the science and everything is so sharp behind it. So we'll see, though. I certainly love playing. I would never want to cut my career short, but I obviously know I'm on the shorter end of it than the longer end, and I don't want to be like that player that's like dragging it on, and then like I have this sort of bitter departure. I have a flair for the dramatic, so...
You don't say.
Hopefully I could go out in a dramatic way.
Well, I'm sure you'll find a way. Before she goes out in style, Rapinoe and the rest of the U.S. women's national team will be in Houston this January for the Olympic qualifying tournament. Rapinoe says she expects her team to take home gold this summer in Tokyo.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world, and when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please, make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
The world's hottest rainforest isn't the Amazon. It's kept under glass in the desert of southern Arizona. Biosphere 2, operated by the University of Arizona, was built 30 years ago as an experiment in space colonization. But now the ecosystems inside are perfect for climate research. Unlike in the real world, scientists can control the elements, which is what they did when they turned off the rain for 2 months. They're tracking how carbon cycles through a rainforest during a drought. As Melissa Siviny from member station KNAU reports, it's a glimpse of what the world might look like in a hotter, drier future.
Scientists know forests soak up about a third of carbon emissions from fossil fuels, but they don't know exactly where that carbon goes or how it's affected by drought. Laura Meredith is director of research at Biosphere 2's rainforest, which is sealed inside a gymnasium-sized pyramid of steel and glass. She wants to find out if ecosystems will respond to droughts in a way that releases carbon and worsens climate change, or
in a way that actually helps mitigate it, helps slow down the process. Maybe they have some mechanisms that allow them to be very resilient and to sort of absorb those changes.
It's a massive experiment with 80-plus scientists from 13 institutions, funded by a $2 million grant from the European Research Council. Inside the Biosphere 2's rainforest is a hollowed-out mountain buzzing with scientific instruments.
So in this room, we have about 20 gas analyzers.
A spider web of plastic tubes links the analyzers to every part of the rainforest.
The plants look a little bit like they're hospitalized with all of the sensors, too. And so we have sap flow sensors, water storage sensors.
The team even had to hire rock climbers to scale the top of the glass dome and hook sensors onto individual leaves. Jana Uren is a biosystems engineer.
We had to order like 20 bags of like turkey bags, like that you would normally cook your Thanksgiving turkey in. And we made little enclosures for leaves.
That's to figure out how plants spend their carbon when they're stressed. Do they store it in roots and leaves, give it away to microbes, or breathe it back into the air as a kind of coping mechanism? Joost van Haren is an earth scientist at the University of Arizona.
Again, it's this resilience that trees have, which is so super cool. And that because of many ways that trees are so different from us humans, that we really don't quite grasp that kind of resilience just yet.
The scientists will collect enough data to fill 20 million books, says cyber infrastructure expert Bonnie Hurwitz.
Everything is wired and linked up, streaming to the cloud, and it gives us an opportunity, unlike any other ecosystem, where we have both the technology and the science in place to really measure and monitor these global processes that are impossible to do in the field.
The idea is to build better models of how ecosystems work. The scientists say those predictions will be crucial as real rainforests continue to heat up. John Adams, deputy director of Biosphere 2, says it was built by people who dreamed of going to other planets, but now it's about protecting our own.
There is only one Earth. Everything just had to come together to make it a suitable atmosphere and conditions for you and I to survive, and you just don't find that anywhere else.
Last week, the team turned the rain back on. Now they'll study the rainforest as it recovers from 2 months of drought. For Here and Now, I'm Melissa Siboney.
Hanukkah starts on Sunday, and Christmas isn't far behind. And yes, I know these two holidays are about a lot more than presents. But if you do still have some shopping to do, Petra Mayer of NPR Books has a few ideas. Petra, it's great to speak with you again.
I'm so glad to be back.
And of course, yes, it is 2019 and people are still giving books. I just want to check in on that every year because it's true. People are still giving books.
Yes.
And the
yes.
number one book on your list, fiction, we'll start there, is Tamsin Muir's Gideon the Ninth. Why do you like this book so much?
Oh, yeah. So every year there's a book that I make all my friends read. This is the one. This is a debut fantasy, and basically the shorthand description that everybody's using is lesbian necromancers in space.
Whoa.
It is this gloriously gothic, crumbling galactic empire where the emperor summons the representatives of the nine houses to come and compete to be his new assistants. They're called lictors in the book, but that's terminology. Anyhow, so we focus on this orphan girl who is a foundling that's been taken in by one of these galactic houses and raised as kind of an outcast, and she ends up accompanying the daughter of the house to this big competition. But she's a sword fighter, and she's just this foul-mouthed, funny, unlike any other female character I've ever read. The writing just drips with style, the relationships are amazing, the world building is so good, and I realized while I was reading the final fight scene, which is just amazingly executed so that you can understand everything that's going on, that all of the characters that I cared about, the protagonists, the big bad, they were all women, but it was so not a big deal that I didn't notice until I was reading the final scene. And then I went, whoa, that's really cool.
All right. Sounds good. Well, you've got another book, and this next one sounds pretty intense. It's called Women Talking, and it's by Marion Taves, also a novel, but based on a real life incident of sexual assault in the Mennonite community in Bolivia. The New York Times is calling it a Mennonite Me Too novel.
Yeah, so this is based on a real story, but the real story is so ghastly that you would not be blamed for thinking that it was a novel. The short version is that there was this isolated Mennonite community in Bolivia where the women discovered that over a period of years, the men had been drugging them at night with an anesthetic spray and then raping them.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's a truly ghastly story. So Miriam Taves herself grew up in a conservative Mennonite community, although not one as isolated as the one in the book. And she kind of wanted to give voice and agency to these women and sort of humanize them, because it's very easy to think of women in that situation as sort of freakishly other, as cultists, right? So she imagines a similar situation, and she puts us in a barn with these women as they discuss what they're going to do, because they've been given 48 hours to decide whether they're going to forgive their attackers or leave the community. And they have these wrenching, brilliant, deep discussions about faith and about forgiveness and about reinterpreting the Bible. And what I really like, just beyond how incredibly intelligent and beautifully written this book is it uses a male narrator actually to kind of flip the script on patriarchy almost, because the center of the book is these women who are talking and discussing and figuring things out for themselves, and the guy's just writing it down. So yeah, it's a wonderful read.
You've got another book for young adult readers. It's Gods of Jade and Shadow. This one's by Sylvia Moreno Garcia. Looks like it is a fairy tale inspired by Mexican folklore. And Petra, if we know something about you, it's that you love fairy tales.
I sure do. I talk about those all day, but that is a whole nother conversation. So fair disclosure, Sylvia Moreno Garcia is an NPR reviewer, but that hasn't stopped us from putting people's books in the concierge in the past, and this one is amazing. It does start out very fairy tale. It starts out with this young woman, and she's kind of a drudge in her rich grandfather's house, but then she finds the dismembered body of the god of death in a locked chest in her grandfather's room, and she opens it and she frees him, and they become sort of spiritually linked, and they go on this big quest. And the thing that I mean, I'm a world-building junkie. That's another thing I love. And this world, she creates this fantasy jazz age Mexico that's built on a magic system that's completely fresh and new if you're used to sort of Western-influenced fantasy. And I also love the relationship between the two main characters, because if this was a traditional fairy tale, you could kind of guess where it was going to go, and it sure does not go there.
You know, Petra, I'm looking at the first three books on this list. Strong, resilient women.
Yeah. You know, I just noticed that myself, too. Well, we have a whole section in the book concierge called Ladies First, and I actually think all of these books are in there.
Hmm. All right. Well, let's do some nonfiction now. The first book on your list is by the journalist Adam Higginbotham, and he wrote Midnight in Chernobyl. I watched HBO's miniseries on Chernobyl this year and was hungry for more, so I'm glad this one's on the list.
Yeah, this is the perfect book for you. And in fact, I was going to mention the HBO miniseries because as good as it was, they just by necessity had to compress a lot of the story, and they had to sort of use some composite characters. So if you want the real deal, this is the book for you. There are a couple of things that I really like about it. The first is that it reads almost like a novel, the way that, you know, he establishes the personalities of all the players. You know, you really feel as if you know them. But the other thing is just this, you get a sense for how unimaginably vast the story is, just
right.
how much you have to understand just to get to the minute of the explosion. And he's really good at leading you through all these things in a way that is clear, but it's not condescending. Like, I learned about nuclear physics and Soviet Central Economic
right,
Planning.
Right, because it's a story about politics, it's a story about people, and of course, it's also a story about science.
Absolutely. And if you want to learn about all those things, this is a great book for you.
All right. Well, add that to the list. And then this one, too. One Day. This is by Jean Weingarten. And as the title says, it focuses on a single day in history, Sunday, December 28th, 1986. Now, I was trying to figure out what was so important about that day. The only thing I could come up with is that Walk Like an Egyptian was the top song.
No way. I love that song. I was probably listening to it on my clock radio on that day. No, well, that's the point, right? So Jean Weingarten had this idea that a skilled journalist could pick any old random day and find a story to tell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he used to be the features editor at the Washington Post, and one of the things he did was make his writers hammer a nail into the phone book and write a profile of whoever the nail stopped at.
Oh, what a character, yeah.
Yeah, so he got people to literally pull a random date out of a hat, and it was this one. And he spent 6 years just digging into all the stuff that happened that day, and as it turned out, there were so many stories.
Oh, I love it.
And some of them are tragic, and some of them are creepy, and some of them are heartwarming. You know, there was a murder, there was a heart transplant, there was a helicopter crash, there was a couple that fell in love in first sight. I loved this book. I ripped through it in an evening. I couldn't put it down because he just takes these stories that, like, wouldn't make it out of the metro section of your local paper, and he lifts them up, and he makes them beautiful and universal.
You know, my journalism professor did this thing once where he put my baseball hat on the table, and he said to the class, I want 100 story ideas about that baseball hat. Go. And that was the entire day we spent just trying to come up with stories. So I relate to this book. I also want to read it. So thanks for that recommendation.
Dude, at least you had a hat. Yeah. My journalism professor was just like, come up with 100 ideas.
Yeah, there was something for us to base it on. All right, I want to put in a plug for a book that I read this year. And this is not even from 2019. In fact, it's from 1947. I was in Berlin in the fall, and I brought along Hans Fallada's Every Man Dies Alone. It's about the German resistance against the Nazis. It was a beautiful, tragic book. And Petra, I don't know about you, but I love to read a book based on the place where I am in that moment. So I just wanted to point that out because that one was on my list for a gift to give this year.
That sounds amazing. I mean, I would like to check it out. I haven't been to Berlin in a long time, but still, sounds like a great read.
Sure. And, you know, if people are listening to this and they still haven't found a book that resonates with them, where should they go?
Oh, well, they should go to npr.org/bestbooks, where the 2019 edition of the Book Concierge lives. And I should say, this year we have more than 350 books in the concierge, but our visuals team, bless them, also rebuilt the whole thing from the ground up to link up every single year going back to 2013. So that is more than 2,000 books.
Oh,
so
cool.
I hope you can find something in there.
Got to find something there for sure. And Petra, we have to take note of today, December 20th. A beloved member of NPR Arts, longtime books correspondent, and of course host, Lynn Neary is retiring today. She's a legend there at NPR. We will all miss her. What parting words do you have for Lynn Neary?
I don't want to part with Lynn. Those
no
are
one
my
does.
Words.
No one
I don't
does.
Know. I mean, she's a consummate professional. She's been everywhere and she's done everything and she can do everything. And also one year she let us use a picture of her as the topper on the arts desk Christmas tree. We called it the Lynn Near Tree. It was the best.
All right. Well, congratulations to Lynn Neary and thank you to Petra Mayer of NPR Books for giving us her picks for the best books of the year. We'll have a link to the NPR Books Concierge at hereandnow.org. Petra, thanks and happy reading.
Thank you. Happy reading to you too.
With Washington consumed by the impeachment hearings this week, something else on Capitol Hill went under the radar. Yesterday, the Senate confirmed 12 of President Trump's judicial nominees. And according to our next guest, the president has now appointed nearly one-fifth of all district court judges and more than a quarter of all appellate judges. Joining us to explain what's happening is Mark Joseph Stern. He covers courts and the law for Slate. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So can you explain why all of these judges were confirmed this week? Because it has to do with a deal that the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell reached with Democrats. Is that correct?
That's right. So Majority Leader McConnell knows that the Senate's going to shut down for an impeachment trial sometime soon, maybe January, maybe a little later. And he wants to confirm as many judges as possible. So he has been striking these deals with senators across the aisle, both Democrats and Republicans, to confirm packages of judges. So the way this works is you'll have a few conservative judges and a few sort of centrist judges who are acceptable to Democrats. And while the Democrats probably won't vote for the conservative judges, they will allow McConnell to bring all of these nominations to the floor as a package, effectively ensuring that all of them will be confirmed.
Okay, so Senate Republicans don't need 60 votes to get these judicial nominees through. We remember that Democratic Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid deployed the so-called nuclear option, getting rid of that 60-vote requirement during the Obama administration. Can you tell us more about how that rule change factors in here?
Sure, absolutely. So this was something Democrats did in 2013 that has come back to haunt them in many ways, because creating this now very low threshold, you only need a simple majority to begin debate and confirm a judge now, that is something Republicans have exploited. And many of these judges do not have support from any Democrats, or only a handful of Democrats. If the filibuster were still around, Democrats could probably block them, but they killed the filibuster and it remains gone. So one of the big reasons why McConnell has been able to push through so many judges is because that nuclear option was reached and they only need a simple majority to get these guys through.
Give us a sense of who these judges are in terms of their backgrounds.
So these judges are remarkably consistent in their backgrounds, both ideologically and in terms of education and club memberships and their work. Many, if not most of them, are members of the Conservative Federalist Society, a network of conservative and libertarian lawyers. Most of Trump's judges are white men. He has really gone in the other direction in terms of diversity from where Obama went. Obama's judges were very diverse. Trump's are mostly just heterosexual white men. And most of them have pretty standard backgrounds, either working in state attorney general's offices. You're not seeing public defenders. You're not seeing civil rights lawyers. You are seeing white shoe law firm lawyers, corporate lawyers, and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Are there any that stick out to you that are controversial?
Certainly. So just this month, the Senate confirmed Sarah Pitlick, who is a very controversial figure, who spent a lot of her earlier career opposing not only abortion in court, but also in vitro fertilization, fertility treatments, under the theory that embryos are human beings. She believes that they should have their own constitutional rights, and yet she was still confirmed.
This has been the talk for quite some time, that this is the strategy of the Trump administration to take over the courts. Can you remind us how long these judges will serve and how big of an impact they are likely to have?
Yes, of course. So these judges will serve for life. These are lifetime appointments, unless they are impeached, which I can assure you they will not be. Barring some extreme unforeseen circumstances, they will be there for as long as they wish, probably through the 2050s and 2060s. A lot of these judges are very young, many in their 30s and early 40s. And the fact that Trump has appointed more than a quarter of all appellate judges on the federal bench tells you all you need to know about how his legacy will survive. The vast majority of federal cases end at the appellate level in these intermediate circuit courts. A huge number of them will be decided by Trump's nominees, so they will effectively have the last say on the law in many cases.
We mentioned that the president has appointed around a fifth of all district court judges, in addition to the two Supreme Court justices you laid out. Is this really unusual for a president?
Absolutely. This is a record pace. Nothing like this has occurred in history, actually. Trump has appointed almost as many judges in less than 3 years as Obama did in 8 years. This is just a confluence of factors here. The abolition of the filibuster for judicial nominees, the incredible pace at which the White House has been nominating them, and Mitch McConnell's procedural genius for creating these packages, getting them to the floor, and getting them through, even on squeaker votes where it's 51-49, McConnell's able to secure those confirmations and move on to the next one.
Mark Joseph Stern covers courts and the law for Slate. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.
From the Me Too movement to Time's Up, it was a big decade in Hollywood for activism, representation, and parity.
People want to see themselves. They want to see their stories reflected. I still say, to this day, I don't think I've seen my own story really reflected accurately.
We look back at how far Hollywood's come and where it's going. That's next time on Here and Now.